This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
It's not Tony Perkins today. This is Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network. I'm talking to you from our studios in Kansas City, and I'm glad to have been asked to guest host for Tony today. It's a real privilege, and always look forward to this opportunity. So hope you're having a great Friday afternoon. As usual, we're going to have a lot of interesting topics today. We're going to give you an opportunity to chime in toward the end of the broadcast in our last segment. I'll be giving you that phone number here after a while. But the topics we're going to cover today include talking about Obamacare and its repeal and its replacement. And we're going to have a guest on here as soon as we get a hold of him who knows an awful lot about that topic. If you remember, let me just take you back in history a little bit about this particular topic. There's a fellow by the name of Jonathan Gruber, who at least at one point was with Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a genius, I'm sure. And he was quoted back in 2014. He actually said this on video back in 2013. He was one of the so-called architects of Obamacare. And he stated that the stupidity of the American voter helped pass the law. Now, here was his quote. He said, "Lack of transparency is a huge political advantage." And basically, call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. But basically, that was really, really critical for the thing to pass, unquote. I don't know if you remember that, but, you know, that kind of gives you a sense of what the people who were crafting that law, the so-called Affordable Care Act, thought about you and I, the American voter. Now, had they told the truth, had they been forthcoming, and had they told us what it was really about, it would never have passed, I'm pretty sure. So here we are, full circle. The election has changed a lot of things. You know, we heard the hope and change theme quite a bit back then, but I think hope and change hopefully really applies to what happened this last election. Things are going to change really, I think, really quickly. Some of the stuff that's been happening, regulatory kinds of things, Obamacare, one of the big things. And in fact, let me just tell you a little anecdote. My wife and I were having lunch today at a local place called Einstein Bagels. You may or may not have them where you live, but it's a great place. It's one of our favorites. The young man who served us had hair down to his back. He had tattoos all over his arms, and I overheard him talking to one of the other customers, talking about how he and his daughter were he had tried to get an Obamacare policy, or he was on one, and it was costing him somewhere close to $400 a month. The deductible was $12,000 a year for he and his daughter. And, you know, from the appearance of this young man, you would think that he would be all in favor of the whole Obamacare thing. But then I had an opportunity to engage him in conversation because he continued to talk to another customer about this. And it was interesting because he was hopeful that with the changes that were coming forth in Washington, that maybe he and his daughter would be better off in terms of what it was going to take to provide them with health care and health coverage. And, you know, I hope the people in Washington, you know, those who are going to be responsible for repealing and replacing Obamacare, have folks in mind like this young man and his daughter. Don't know anything more about his life situation, but, you know, here was an individual, day-to-day living, you know, working hard and serving other people in his job, probably not getting paid an awful lot. But yet he still has to provide and to have the kinds of incredible costs, the cost increases that we saw with Obamacare just have made it impossible for many, many people. And so hopefully we're going to be able to get into that with our guest once our folks get him on the line here. But, you know, just thinking about what was said, that they were taking advantage of, quote unquote, and, you know, the American voter is not stupid. But, you know, to call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever, basically saying that was really, really, really critical for this thing to pass, is just amazing. What I want to do is play a short soundbite from Paul Ryan for you to kind of set up this segment. And by the way, the other segments, just briefly want to tell you what else we're going to be talking about today. You're going to learn what a Bible study and donuts have to do with one another at the bottom of the hour, a little bit later in the hour. I'm sure you're intrigued to find out why those two have some kind of an intersection. And then our segment starting at the bottom of the hour on through the rest of the program, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court and the potential Supreme Court nominees with one of our good friends here at Bot Radio Network, Kelly Shackelford, who is the president and CEO of First Liberty Institute. Kelly knows all about this stuff. He's been studying it. He studied 10,000 decisions, I think is what he talked about. They looked at with all of these potential candidates. So that's what's in store for you today, as well as your ability to chime in and call during the last segment. So let's play this sound clip from Paul Ryan, if you would.
As Republicans, we could just say, I think the president-elect said this yesterday, we could just sit back and watch it all happen and say, well, look at what the Democrats did. That would be irresponsible for us to do that. So we have to step in and rescue people from the collapse of this law. We want to instead have tax credits so that everybody can have a shot at buying, take their tax credit and go buy a health care plan of their choosing. And that's the other thing. We don't want to make people buy something that they don't want to buy.
Well, you know, and that goes right back to that story I told you about the young man who served my wife and I today at the Einstein Bagel shop. You know, it's got to be something that people can afford. Healthcare is such an important thing. And you know, the House, by the way, passed a measure to set up an effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Senators voted to start that process yesterday. And we're so fortunate to have on the line with us Robert Leshefsky. He's the president of the Health Policy and Strategy Associates Organization. Bob, thanks for joining us today on Washington Watch.
Glad to be here.
Well, you know, you and I had an opportunity to touch bases a little bit earlier today, and my goodness, it sounds like you've been involved in this whole thing for quite a while. And of course, your organization is involved in consulting to a number of different clients about this topic. Briefly, tell us a little bit about your background and why you know so much about this topic.
Well, I started out in the health insurance business 40 years ago, came up through the ranks in the insurance industry. I ultimately ran two health plans as the chief operating officer. And then about 20 years ago, with a passion for healthcare policy and fixing the health insurance system, I started my own business in Washington, D.C. And we advise people who are in the business of healthcare, insurance companies, doctor organizations, hospital organizations, and so forth. And we don't lobby. We're not advocates for anything. Our job is to tell our clients what is going to happen and how it's going to impact them. So they expect generally objective information because they've got a business to run. And I guess we're unique because I have both the experience of running the business and I have the experience inside the Beltline. So hopefully we've got a better perspective than most people in that regard.
You know, a lot of folks have heard many things over the past number of years since Obamacare was passed on a party line vote with no Republicans supporting it whatsoever. And by the way, before you got online here, I was quoting Jonathan Gruber and his comment about how it required the stupidity of the American people to pass this thing. If you would briefly just review from your perspective some of the many shortcomings of Obamacare and why. For instance, you know, one of Donald Trump's first priorities is to get this thing thrown out and get it fixed. What have been some of the real shortcomings of this thing?
Well, I think fundamentally there are two things. The first is it wasn't done in a bipartisan way, and we can have a big argument amongst people in Washington as to how much fault that is of the Republicans and so forth. But the fact that it wasn't done in any kind of bipartisan way meant that it leaned far left. There was no compromise. And it was rammed through. The second problem is it wasn't designed by people who've actually ever done this for a living. It was designed by people like Professor Gruber at MIT, who I'm sure are quite intelligent, but have never actually worked in the health insurance environment and don't know how this works. And one of the first things they should have understood is if you don't offer attractive health plans to people, they're not going to buy them. And if they don't buy them, only the sick people will sign up. The healthy people will stay away, which is exactly what's happened. The fundamental problem with Obamacare is because it's so unattractive to the consumer, it's so expensive with big deductibles, is only 40% of the subsidy eligible have signed up. Now think about this for a second. The law says unless you're covered by Medicare, Medicaid, or your employer, you have to sign up or you're going to be fined. And if your income is not terribly high, we're going to subsidize you and help you pay for it. And I think most people would rather have health insurance than not have health insurance. After being told they need to sign up or they'll be fined, after being told there will be subsidies available, only 40% of the market bought it. And what's fundamentally happened is, you know who those 40% are, they're the disproportionately sick. And that's driven the prices way up. So what we've got is a very poorly designed system, designed by people who've never really done this before, think in an academic environment like Professor Gruber, they know everything, and we got a mess on our hands.
Well, what do you think the intent was originally? And if some have said that it was designed to fall apart and fail so that we could go to a single-payer system. What's your view on that?
I don't think it was that overt. I think that people on the left felt that if it didn't work, they sort of felt like they were giving an insurance companies a chance to be part of the system, and if the insurance companies failed in that effort, then we would go to single-payer, and that wouldn't be a bad thing either. I don't think they intended for it to fail. I think they intended for it to succeed. One of the things that's always troubled me about the advocates for Obamacare is they'll continue to tell you that you have all these people who have signed up, they have health insurance they never had before, 85% of the people are getting subsidies. How many times have you heard it said that 85% of the people are getting subsidies? That's terribly misleading. 85% of the people in the insurance exchanges are getting subsidies, which is the only place you can get a subsidy. In fact, half of the Obamacare-compliant market does not get a subsidy. We have people buying health insurance that are not subsidy eligible. They don't buy it in the exchange. There's no reason for them to be in the exchange because that's where the subsidies are. Half the people who are in Obamacare-compliant policies do not get a subsidy. This plan was really designed for the poorer people. Between the Medicaid expansion and the way the subsidies are structured, Obamacare actually does a pretty good job of covering poor people. People with very low incomes are paying very low premiums and paying very low deductibles. But if you're working class or middle class, you're still paying really high premiums and you're still paying these really high deductibles. And if you're fortunate enough to make enough money not to get a subsidy, which is where half the people in the country are, you get no assistance whatsoever for these incredibly expensive plans.
Now, we only have about a minute left, and I know this is going to be a real chore, but, you know, one of the mantras coming out of the White House and from Democrats is that, well, the Republicans are going to repeal Obamacare, and they're going to leave 20, 30 million people uninsured. They don't have a plan. Answer that one.
Well, of course, the Republicans have a plan. I think the Republicans have done a really poor job since the election. I think coming out of the election, they've been overconfident, feeling they have a mandate to deal with Obamacare. And they forgot to restate their case. And they have not done a good job of telling people that they are not going to pull the rug out from under people. I think the clip you played from Speaker Ryan a few minutes ago was good. And they're finally saying the right things. But they've left this without being able to detail what they're going to do. And detail doesn't mean like full legislation. It's an outline that people can understand so they can be confident. Without detailing that, they've left a vacuum, an information and gap, and the Democrats have really been taking them to town. They've been using them as a pinata, saying that they're gonna rip everybody's health insurance out, and all these people are gonna lose coverage. That was never the intent. The Republicans have got to do a much better job of messaging, because I think they're starting to lose the messaging war post-election because of this overconfidence.
Right. Robert Leshefsky, the president of the Health Policy and Strategy Associates Organization, thanks so much for lending your expertise to our conversation here.
You're welcome.
Well, what do donuts and Bible studies have to do with each other? We'll find out here in just a minute in our next segment of Washington Watch.
From the ruling to uphold Obamacare's individual mandate, to the ruling to redefine marriage, to the ruling that allows the government to seize a citizen's home, these are the many important decisions that the United States Supreme Court has made recently. But did you know that each of these three decisions was determined by a one-vote margin? The Supreme Court's decisions affect all of us, and it decides about 70 cases every year. Over the next 8 years, we could get as many as 4 new Supreme Court justices. Furthermore, these justices will have a huge impact on the sanctity of human life, religious liberty, and the size and scope of government, and even parental rights. Join Family Research Council Action as we work to ensure the confirmation of Supreme Court justices who will uphold the Constitution and simply apply the law as the founders intended. Become a member today at frcaction.org. That's frcaction.org.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. When Charlotte, North Carolina sought to force businesses to allow men to use women's restrooms, the state legislature passed the bill HB 2 to protect the privacy and safety of women and girls. The left has since brought incredible pressure upon the state for merely upholding a basic tenet of civilized society. With the defeat of Governor McCrory, who courageously defended the law, it looked as if HB 2 would be repealed, yet the state Senate stood strong and upheld the law. As Lieutenant Governor Forrest stated, "No economic, political, or ideological pressure can convince me that what is wrong is right. Those who are pushing this agenda will not stop until their social engineering is accomplished. The only thing stopping them are those of us who continue to stand strong," unquote. We commend these honorable leaders. May God give us more of them. This is a Decency Minute. Find us at AmericanDecency.org. I'm Bill Johnson.
Hi, this is Steve Tiber with 8 Days of Hope. 1,790 families have had their homes rebuilt because of you, the listener at American Family Radio, when you've partnered with 8 Days of Hope. We've been all over the country helping disaster victims to no fault of their own who lose everything to see volunteers show up and help them rebuild. 2 years ago, we started a rapid response division that goes within 72 hours and since then have gone to 15 communities across America. Would you consider becoming a part of 8 Days of Hope as we continue to look for ways to grow the ministry in 2017, please go to our website, 8daysofhope.com, and click on Get Involved, submit your email address, and the next time we go anywhere with a disaster, we'll invite you to come along as well. Please continue to pray for the ministry as we look forward to what God has in store for us. Thank you so much for your prayers, your financial support, and volunteering with 8 Days of Hope.
AFR urges you to support the ministry of 8 Days of Hope at 8daysofhope.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in today for Tony Perkins. By the way, speaking of Tony Perkins, he has a Twitter account. It's at T Perkins. And you can also get lots of great information at frc.org, frc.org, Family Research Council. Subscribe to the daily emails. They're very, very informative, and quite frankly, they're a lot of fun. I love the headlines because they're usually puns. Some people say puns are the lowest form of humor. I totally disagree with that, and I love the headlines that come through. So go to frc.org, find out more about Family Research Council. And also, you can link to archives of this program in case you missed part of a program or all of a program. Love to have you do that. FRC.org. And again, the Twitter account for Tony is at T Perkins. Speaking of Twitter, by the way, if you haven't subscribed to Donald Trump's Twitter feed, it's quite entertaining. And you'll find out everything before the news media tells you because they seem to be quite focused on that. Anyway, let's get on with our next topic here and find out why donuts and Bible studies have a connection. You know, the Joplin, Missouri School District halted a middle school Bible study that provided donuts to those who participated. This comes after a complaint from the American Humanist Association, which alleged that school employees and clergy use the donuts to entice students to come to the Bible study. With us now is Donna Hearn, founder and president of the Missouri-based Constitution Coalition. Donna, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Evan, and it's just a pleasure to be on Tony's program. I love Tony.
Well, yes, so do we. So do we. Well, you know, tell us what you know about this situation going on in Joplin. And, you know, this is just one example of this kind of thing happening all over the place. But tell us what you know about it.
It is a tired, tired story, Evan, because it happens all the time. Just a quick synopsis, the Joplin School District actually was sued by our good nemesis, the American Humanist Association, in December because they had a Bible study. And it's always a little bit deceptive the way they do these things. The Bible study was before school started, It was during a time which they called the breakfast time. As many of you know, many of the public schools provide breakfast for many of the students free. And so, therefore, a lot of students, if you're on that program, you get to come and have breakfast. Well, this was a Bible study in that particular time frame. It was not during the actual hours of school. It was an outside activity, essentially. And how dare they provide donuts for these kids? I mean, this was the sin of all sins, that they were enticing the children to come to their Bible study with donuts. Now, the problem is, if you get into the finer details, number one, you don't really know who is named and who's leading the Bible study, what kind of a Bible study is it, who are the parents involved, how many kids. It's kind of a bad job of reporting, quite frankly. But, of course, all it takes is one parent or one citizen in the community to file a lawsuit, and the schools basically pulling their shirt tails and go running. In this case, it was in a middle school, and there has been a policy in the Joplin School District that the schools can have a Bible study, and it was in the upper school, it was called secondary education. But, my day, we had grammar school and we had high school. Now we have,
right.
Now we have elementary school, middle school, and we have secondary school, and it's kind of playing around with terms. But that was the main reason that the Joplin School District said to pull it, is because they didn't have a policy on the middle school. Not that they were opposed to the Bible study, because they do have it in the senior schools. But let me just address this issue. I'm located here in St. Louis, Missouri, and my memory is a little short, but it's got to be at least 30-some years ago. There was a school district here. There's a school district here called the Ladue School District, and there was a gal who went on to actually become a state senator in Missouri. That time she was a member of the Ladue School Board, and she did a Bible study outside after school and, of course, was sued. It was taken all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was ruled perfectly legitimate. So, the problem is the schools are frightened because they are threatening to sue them. And the way the lawsuits are today, and this is one of the fastest things that could be done by the Trump administration to stop some of these things. When the lawsuit is filed, and let's just say the school district just suddenly looks at a big bill. They don't have it, so they say they basically agree to whatever the demands are and fork over some money or whatever. But if they go on into court and they are fearful that they're going to lose the money that they will have to spend, actually they end up paying for the other side's attorneys. And this is how the American Humanist Society gets its money to file all these lawsuits, is because they're really running on the school district money that they have won in other districts because of basically, capitulation on the issue. And so one of the best things that could be done is that if you file a lawsuit and you go into these court cases, you don't pay for the other side attorneys. Particularly if this case, it doesn't go very well, doesn't go anywhere. The left has learned this lesson. They do this in the environmental cases. They do this in the ACLU cases. They do their fundraising on the backs of whoever they're suing. They end up having to pay for this. But the problem here is, Evan, this is perfectly legal. It's actually even legal to have the Bible in the classroom because we do not have discrimination of speech content. And if we start saying, well, this is permissible and this is not, we are getting into judging the content of speech. And the courts have historically ruled this cannot go on. So consequently, if you've got courageous school board members, they can stick up and say, we're not only going to have Bible studies before and after school, but we're going to teach the Bible in school itself. And there are curriculums out there that are being used, across the school districts as we talk now that are being taught in.
Yeah, and if they get in a pickle, there are several great organizations that can help them. Donna Hearn, founder and president of the Constitution Coalition, based right here in Missouri. Thanks so much for your time today. Good to talk with you again.
You're certainly welcome.
Well, in our next segment, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump, and he says he's going to nominate a Supreme Court justice within 2 weeks of his inauguration, which is 1 week from today. Kelly Shackelford, president and CEO of First Liberty Institute, will be here to review who might be on that shortlist. Stay with us.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Well, certainly no one's been more critical of the Obama administration and its pretend economic counsel or advisors that he has surrounded himself with. Then there is, of course, the economically inept Congress that we have been dealing with for the last 10 years that I've also been very critical about. And let's not forget my criticism of the Federal Reserve and the irrelevancy of the Federal Reserve and the politicizing of the Federal Reserve. So having said all that, the Federal Reserve's chief, Janet Yellen, spoke this week, and she was talking about the Dodd-Frank law. I've also, by the way, have been critical of overly regulating businesses, including the financial sector, and how this is, in the long term, going to be detrimental to businesses and the banking system. And of course, I am a free trade, free market economist. I've supported Donald Trump's pro-growth plan. I believe in his cabinet and his economic advisors, and I think he's going to be good for America. But I've got to agree with Janet Yellen. Janet Yellen does not believe, nor do I, should the capital requirements and the enhanced supervision requirements of big banks that Dodd-Frank has put into place shouldn't be scrapped. I think it's part of the bill that we've got to keep. I think we cannot be so naive as to believe that big banks aren't going to begin taking undue risk once again, and that regulatory supervision is not necessary. So I have to agree with Janet Yellen, don't always, but I think she's right on this, and hopefully we will see that part of the bill stay intact.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler with Lot Radio Network sitting in for Tony Perkins on this great Friday afternoon. I don't know what the weather's looking like where you are, but they've been predicting an ice storm here in the Midwest, and I know our good friends in St. Louis got hit this morning. So hopefully everybody, it won't be as bad as they're saying. Sometimes they inflate it, and we hope that they did inflate it because ice is not nice, right? Okay, well, President-elect Donald Trump has reportedly shortened his 21-name shortlist of potential Supreme Court nominees. And someone who is closely following that, and I mean closely, is our good friend Kelly Shackelford. He's the president and CEO of First Liberty Institute. Kelly, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, happy to be on, Evan.
All right. Well, apparently you've been studying a lot of the decisions and briefs and such that these 21 shortlist folks have been involved with over the past few years. Give us a little bit of insight into who they are and, you know, maybe some of your top picks if you were the guy picking them.
Well, the great news is, you know, as candidate Trump was trying to do, he wanted a list of really good, solid conservative folks, and so there, as you can imagine, there are a lot of great people on the list. You know, there's 21 of them. We reviewed, I don't know that anybody else has done this, I hadn't heard publicly, but we did. We've actually reviewed all the decisions. There's over 10,000 opinions when you add them up, and we reviewed those. And, you know, as you might guess, when you review 10,000 opinions, there are some that might give you trouble. You go, oh, why am I so sure about these? But the great thing is there's so many great people on the list that there's plenty of great choices. And so he's going to have, I think, a clear ability to pick a really solid conservative jurist who, as he said, you know, will be like a Scalia. And so I think it's going to be fascinating to see who he announces. And I've got some that I think are, you know, stronger maybe than others. But, you know, the decision you kind of got to make if you're him is some of these have longer records than others, although they all, you know, have a conservative pedigree. And so do you pick somebody who's really solid, but maybe they don't have quite as many opinions, or, you know, who's maybe they're younger and going to be on the court longer? Or do you pick somebody who's a little older and maybe has a few more decisions, but maybe has one that people are questioning? Or so those are the kinds of decisions you got to make when you look through, because you're like trying to read the future, and you really don't want to mess up, because this is Scalia's seat. So you can almost, you know, if you're Donald Trump, you kind of feel sorry for him, because you're kind of like, well, the best you can do is stay even if you're trying to pick a conservative. So you want to make sure you get that right.
That's right, and Scalia was a great conservative, a great jurist. You know, I can't remember ever in the past when a president, a candidate even who had not been elected, because Trump laid out at least a list, I think, initially of about 13 or so, even before he was elected. I can't remember anything like that in the past. Can you?
No, it's never been done. He actually laid out all 21. Before he was elected, and he made a promise that he would pick Scalia's replacement from this list. So everybody can look at the list and go, it's going to be one of these 21. And the question is, which one? And there's some great people. There's some of them would be really fun to watch. For instance, Justice Willett, who's on the Texas Supreme Court, he's Scalia with a Twitter account. He's known for having a huge bunch of followers because he's really funny and very witty. And you know, they ask him why, as a judge, he had a Twitter account. And because in Texas, where he's from, you run for office every 6 years. And so he's like, this is great name ID. And that way, when I run, you know, people know who I am and support it. But, you know, the irony of that and Trump and his Twitter account, that would be fascinating, right?
It would.
There's a guy by the name of Thomas Hardiman, who is from Pennsylvania, which, again, a very key state for Trump, right? And none of the cabinet posts or anybody has been from Pennsylvania yet. Well, Thomas Hardiman is like a hero on the Second Amendment. I mean, he's issued some powerful stuff. And he's also done really well on religious freedom. And he's got a, you know, really interesting background. Grew up a hardworking guy, kind of a blue-collar guy who worked to pay for himself at college and through law school. And he's actually, you know, interesting thing, he's married to a woman in a Democratic family, but he's not. He's very conservative and has been real consistent with his opinions. And so you can see there's a guy, Raymond Grunder, who actually has a incredible story of being shot by his father and then him stopping his father before he shot his brother. And then the life that's come as a result. And this guy's a really solid conservative judge at the Federal Court of Appeals and has some wonderful opinions. So there's a lot of these kinds of people, and you're just going, you know, this could be really interesting, but whoever he picks, he's got some great choices with some solid records where he's not having to guess at what they're going to do.
Wow, that's great. And so you've studied, what do you said, about 10,000 different opinions among this group?
Yeah, there's over 10,000 opinions when you add up the 21 judges. There are some judges that have over 3,000, 4,000 opinions, that they've written.
That's amazing. Well, we're going to hold you over into the next segment because I want to talk a little bit about some of the why this pick for a Supreme Court justice to fill Scalia's position is so, so important to the country, to the future of the country. Maybe talk about some of the decisions that can be impacted by that choice. And I want to give our listeners a phone number here because we want you to engage and have an opportunity to talk with Kelly. That number is 866-372-7234. Let me repeat that, 866-372-7234. Go ahead and get on the line, get on hold. You may have to wait a few minutes, but we'd love to talk with you and have you ask questions about, in particular, about this Supreme Court topic. Maybe we can talk about some of the other things that we discussed earlier in the broadcast. 866-372-7234. Be right back.
Hey, do you want to go on a vacation with a purpose? Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. A lot of people love to go to the beach. I'm one of them. How about the mountains? Yeah, a lot of folks are raising their hand right now when I say the mountains. Well, This year, why don't you go with us on a spiritual heritage tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and have a vacation with an educational and a spiritual purpose. If you'd like to go with us in June or September to D.C. and Mount Vernon, or our separate tour to Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown, we'd love to have you join us. Just find out all the information at spiritualheritagetours.com. Stephen McDowell of the Providence Foundation will join us as our historian, and he'll be commenting all along the way on our rich Christian heritage here in the U.S. We hope you can join us, spiritualheritagetours.com.
Hello, I'm John Nyhoff, the president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Wesley Biblical Seminary provides a solid foundation based upon the inerrancy of the Bible and the call to holy living. Online or at our Jackson, Mississippi or Greenwood, Indiana campuses, our academically rigorous learning community will add incredible value to your Christian experience. Wesley Biblical Seminary, where faith and learning ignite with passion for Christ. WBS.edu.
It's back. The seasonal favorite from American Family Coffee is here for Valentine's Day. Devotion, the popular chocolate raspberry flavored ground coffee, is available in a 12-ounce bag for your coffee lover for Valentine's. A mild coffee with a hint of fresh raspberries and sweet chocolate from American Family Coffee. Visit afastore.net or call 877-927-4917.
We're in the financial business. We manage a couple of trusts and some estates, and of course, our own monies too.
Courtney Trotter talks about the charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation.
I understand annuities about as much as anyone, I guess, can. So I just felt the charitable gift annuity was a win-win situation for many people that still are generating income and still have assets. Because you never know when you may have to draw down on something like that. And if you don't ever have to, then it's even a better gift to get to a really good foundation like AFA. A very solid investment, a good way to help do the Lord's work, and it's there to help us as well.
Find out if the charitable gift annuity can work for you by calling the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in for Tony Perkins this Friday afternoon. And we've been talking with Kelly Shackelford about the Supreme Court picks that President-elect, who almost President Trump, has proposed to fill the seat of Justice Scalia. And of course, as you probably know, there are a number of other possibilities. There are some of the justices who may not be on the court that much longer. So there's a possibility that there could be maybe one, maybe two more seats beyond this that could be filled. We lost our connection with Kelly and trying to get him back on the line here. And what I want to ask him about is a little bit more about some of the important decisions that the Supreme Court is looking at that will be impacted. I guarantee you will be impacted by what kind of justices are on the court. And let me give you the phone number again, because we'd like to hear from you and hear your questions here before the end of the hour. 866-372-7234. 866-372-7234. That's our call-in line for Washington Watch. And we'd love you to join in the conversation if you've got a few minutes this afternoon. Well, Kelly's back on the line. Kelly, how are you?
Good.
Good. There we go. Well, if, you know, phones sometimes disconnect, that's the way it goes. You know, let's talk about some of the important decisions that are out there that could well be impacted by who President-elect Trump puts on the court in place of Justice Scalia. What are some of those?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, there's so many cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court 5-4. I mean, let's take the issue of the Second Amendment. You had, at the time of Scalia, you had a 5-4 decision. You had four members of the court who actually believed that you didn't have an individual right to own a firearm under the Second Amendment. So if you were to change that by one, you'd have a majority, and the Second Amendment would really somewhat not be in place. You've got the Hobby Lobby case, which was a case that was about, I mean, this, literally the argument by the government was that once you go into a for-profit business, you are waiving your religious freedoms. You don't have religious freedoms in for-profit business. And, you know, I was sitting in the front of the Supreme Court listening to this argument from the Solicitor General. Just could not believe what I was hearing. Well, you know, that was, you know, everybody knows Hobby Lobby won. But what a lot of people don't realize is they won 5-4.
That's right. It was slim.
And that was Justice Scalia, the fifth vote. So that's just the beginning. I mean, there's a whole long line of this. Let's take Roe v. Wade. You know, if you replace Scalia with another conservative, you probably are not going to overturn Roe v. Wade. But the next justice, you probably would replace. You probably would have the ability to overturn Roe v. Wade. So it could be as, you know, as early as 2 years from now, we could be looking at something that major. So we could go down the list of a long list of these, but I think religious freedom, the Second Amendment, life, and on and on and on and on, almost all of these, or many of them certainly, have been 5-4. And that's one way or the other. So whichever way, that's why so many people, the number one issue in the election, it wasn't even close for people of faith, was the Supreme Court, and it's because I think they realized this, and they realized so many of the issues like religious freedom, life, the Second Amendment, et cetera, were all being decided by the court.
Yeah, and so it's not, as you point out, it's not just future cases, it's previous cases, and in the case of the Second Amendment, the Heller and McDonald cases could be, they could take another look at those if the court was in such a position that they didn't like it, and they could flip those back, couldn't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's it's all going to be open, and plus there are cases on their way now. I mean, we have a case. We just filed a cert in the Supreme Court 2 days before Christmas on a case with a Marine who was actually court-martialed because she wouldn't remove a scripture verse from her personal work area. That's on its way right now. I mean, we've got two cases at the Federal Court of Appeals that are almost there. One involves a veterans memorial that's a cross that's been up for over 90 years that the American Humanists are asking be torn down. Another one is whether you can have prayer before before county commissioners meetings that the ACLU is on the other side from us. I mean, all of these, there's many of these that are almost there or on their way there, in addition to the issues we already know from the past that were 5-4 that certainly will be coming up as soon as the next justice is chosen.
Well, Kelly, we have some callers lined up here. You want to chat with a few of our listeners?
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
First of all, we have Rob online from Mississippi. He wants to talk about the Supreme Court nominations. Rob, welcome to Washington Watch.
I appreciate you taking my call. I'm going to hang up and listen after I ask my question, but what do you think the realistic chances are that President Trump will nominate at least two justices in his first 4 years? And like I said, I'll hang up and listen, but appreciate your let me take my call. Thank you.
Yeah, Rob. Rob, thanks for the call. I was going to ask you that question, too, and you did mention that that at least perhaps one other slot might open up that needs to be filled. What's your guess on the first 4 years here in terms of how many other justices might have to be replaced?
I do think he's going to have at least two, if not more. The odds are just on, you know, history and the ages of the justices. There are three justices. I mean, after Scalia, which will be number one, there are three justices on the court above 78 years old. And so the odds are that at least one of those justices will step down in those first 4 years, and maybe two. So, I mean, he very well could have three in his first 4 years. There are many who are saying they've been praying and prophesying and all this about a Trump presidency before any of us heard of Trump, and the rumor's been going around that he's going to have 8 years and five justices. If he does that, that would be pretty major.
Sure.
Have a Trump court for, you know, probably the rest of our life, I guess. That would be a long time after that. But definitely he's going to have one. I think it's highly likely he has two. I think it's very possible he has three just in the first 4 years.
And to the point you just made, you know, before the election occurred, there was just constant conversation about the importance of the Supreme Court and the fact that that whoever was going to be the president would have an impact on the court, not just for a few years, but potentially for an entire generation, because these folks, once they get on the court, it's a lifetime appointment. Well, Charles is on the line from South Carolina, wants to talk about judicial supremacy. Charles, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, both you guys. By the way, it's an honor to speak with Mr. Perkins, my favorite punster. I mean, I assume you write the titles of the articles that you send out by email. If that's you, you got kudos from me.
I wish it was. You know, I wish it was, Charles. And I, for those of you who don't know what Charles is referring to, earlier in the broadcast, I talked about the daily emails that come out from Family Research Council and how their headlines are just by themselves are worth a read. So we'll tell you how to subscribe to those later. Charles, you've got a question or a comment about judicial supremacy.
I want to say that we've got several people like Robertson and Kennedy on the court that we felt confident about. You know, their records looked like they were going to rule okay, and they've stabbed us in the back. We've had four of the worst decisions in the past, even with Scalia on the court. That's important to remember. They twice with Obamacare, once with gay marriage, and the worst decision of all because it made state local governments vassals of the feds, and that was Dallas Fair Housing. The point I want to make is that judicial supremacy is the last thing that the founders had on their mind. They wanted the judicial branch to be the weakest. They wanted all three branches to be able to review the constitutionality of each other. If they make an unconstitutional decision, and all four of those certainly were, Obama understands this, not based on the Constitution. He understands that if he doesn't like a decision, he ignores it. But when it's unconstitutional, all three branches and the states have an obligation to nullify. And until we realize that, these guys are going to keep letting us down like Roberts did twice on Obamacare, and no matter how good they look. And by the way, I would dispute that Bill Pryor, who went after tooth and nail Judge Moore in Alabama, I dispute that he has a good record. I don't know about the rest of them, but he's the only one that I recognize. And I would say that I'm disappointed that Judge Moore is not on there, that his colleague Judge Parker, and Reed O'Connor in Texas, he's looking awful good. I hope the rest of these guys are good, but we can pack the court, and they're arm twisting the things that can be done unless we realize that when they do something unconstitutional, it's not the law. They can't make law. If we don't do that, you know, we're shot.
Well, Charles, it sounds like you've been studying this, and thanks for those comments and for reminding us about those two really bad decisions that Roberts was involved in with Obamacare. Kelly, you want to comment on what Charles had to say?
Yeah, boy, Charles had a lot of great things to say. Really is in the know in a lot of different ways, more than most. He mentioned Bill Pryor, who was seen by many as a legend because of what he did in his confirmation hearing, where he was, you know, in confirmation hearings with U.S. senators, very few people would say what he said, which is basically that Roe v. Wade's an abomination, and he almost didn't get confirmed because of that. And so a lot of people really look highly on him. But as you were just mentioning, he's also the one who prosecuted Roy Moore, and a lot of people didn't like that about Judge Pryor, and then there are some decisions out there that people are questioning as well. So he's one of the ones that, you know, there's been a couple articles even today where people are arguing about. But for most of them, we don't see that. We don't see decisions or things, and it's not because they don't have a record. And that's the main thing. In the past, Republicans used to always try to put people up without a record, thinking that they'll get them through and nobody will know. And of course, the problem is if you're 50 or 60 years old and you don't have a record of any conservative history, then maybe that there's a reason for that.
Yeah, that gives you a clue right there, doesn't it?
It does. And so I think that's the difference here is you've got people with long records who've shown their judicial philosophy, and so I think he's right. There are some real opportunities to set the court. And I do think he's right also about this was the court was not supposed to have the power that it has. The reason that it having this focus and this power is because of judicial activism where judges are doing things they shouldn't do. Many of these things are not in the Constitution. You know, whether it's, let's talk about the couple you just mentioned. You know, abortion's not in the Constitution. You know, gay marriage, it's not in the Constitution. And I think people who are being honest will admit that, and therefore those are left to the states and left to the legislative process to be fought about. When judges take those out of the hands of the people and begin to decide those things for the whole country, that's really a misuse of their position, and it creates them as being much more powerful, much more political, which they weren't supposed to be, and that's why we see this focus. The good news is, if, let's say, a President Trump were to put, you know, conservative judicial restraint type justices on there, then what you would have is judges who would say, look, my job is not to create law, not to create new things. If it's not in the Constitution, if it's not in the federal law, I'm not going to be defending it. I'm going to defer and let you, you know, let people in the legislative process deal with these. We would return back to a proper role for the court. It might not even get the focus it's getting now, but that would only be if you replaced the court and moved it in that direction where you had a lot more people like Scalia who think, you know, there's a lot of bad things that go in the world, but their job is not to fix it all. Their job is to be a judge and to simply follow the law.
That's right. Well, Matthew's on the line from Oklahoma, wants to talk about laws and about this topic. Matthew, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys, all you do. And my question was, sir, at what point do we begin to recognize that, you know, taking a look at the 10th Amendment, where the states have the rights to make that decision over and above what were issued from the Supreme Court? And I know that might sound crazy, but in light of what Dr. King said at one point in his life, he said that any law that was issued that was an unjust law is no law at all. And, you know, the 10th Amendment basically gives the states the right to make decisions that weren't listed in the Constitution. And could you kind of shed some light on those things? Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew.
Well, I mean, you know, kind of referencing Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail, right, and almost towards civil disobedience when you get into laws that go against God's laws. Again, you hope you never get to that point in this country, and I think the definite message that was sent in the election, because this was a major issue, that people wanted a different kind of appointment to the Supreme Court, to move things back, I think is helpful to avoid that ever happening, where all of a sudden you had to choose between your faith and your government. You know, I mean, many of our brothers and sisters around the world do have to make that decision. God forbid we ever come to that decision in the United States. But the whole point of the 10th Amendment is, you know, if something's not covered in the Constitution, it goes back to the states and to local and to the citizens. That's where the power is supposed to reside. And so when you have things being federalized, whether by Congress or by the Supreme Court, by creating constitutional rights that are not in the Constitution, you really are stripping away power from the people. You're really disregarding the 10th Amendment. And that's something that I think, you know, this administration will definitely move back in that other direction of not doing that. And those are the kinds of justices that he has promised to appoint, people like a Scalia and a Thomas, who that's their very philosophy of really returning power back to the people and not having judges that think they're the answers to all the problems. And,
well, Kelly,
they don't run for re-election. They don't have those other kinds of things like legislators are supposed to have.
Well, Kelly Shackelford, president and CEO of First Liberty Institute, thank you for giving us so much of your time. We know you're a busy guy, and the work that First Liberty Institute does is fantastic. Thanks for being our guest today and bringing some light to this
this topic. Happy to do it. Anybody can go to firstliberty.org and look at the cases and see what's ahead.
Thanks again. Appreciate it so much.
Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.